Welcome to episode 300 of Transit Unplugged. I'm host and producer Paul Comfort. When we started the podcast in November of 2017, my goal was to shine a light on the positive impact of public transportation on communities and give transit leaders a chance to share the good news about their agencies, services, innovations, and their careers, unfiltered and unplugged. Now, 7 years later, while the hot topics have changed, we continue to meet these issues head on with frank discussions about how agencies are addressing their challenges and how it's shaping them as leaders. We're celebrating this milestone with a CEO roundtable featuring four leading transit CEOs talking about their agencies, what it's like to be a CEO, and the challenges they face today. Recorded live on stage with me at the Think Transit Conference are Frank White III of Kansas City Area Transportation Authority, Tiffany Scott from Paratransit Inc., David Scorey of Keolis North America, and Jameson Auten of Lane Transit District. If you like what you hear on the podcast, help spread the news by being a transit evangelist yourself and share the program with your work colleagues and friends. The more we all understand industry best practices and career advice for transit leaders, the more all of us can help improve public transportation to provide better service and become even more integral to our communities. Now come with me on stage at the Transit Unplugged Live CEO Roundtable. Great to have you with us today for Transit Unplugged Live and our CEO Roundtable. I'm Paul Comfort, your host, and excited to bring to you today these great leaders in our industry. You know, it's important for us to hear from leaders in the public transportation industry. There's so many challenges we're facing right now. It's an important time to kind of get a glide on the trends that are happening. Today, we're going to talk to these CEOs about their lives, their careers, what it's like to be a CEO every day, and the things they have to deal with. So our public transit industry right now, I believe, is in a very precarious situation. As you know, the pandemic really was a gut punch to transit agencies across the country and across the world with ridership and all the changes we had to do, all the new hygiene things we had to do on the buses to clean them more often. And now coming out of that, though, we're in an interesting place, right? I mean, I'm sure you're aware you've heard this term called a fiscal cliff. So what that is because the pandemic took out so many riders, that also affected passenger revenue for most transit agencies. And the federal governments in the U.S. and Canada subsidized those for the last like 2.5 years. But those funds are ending. For most transit agencies, this year is when they'll spend them down. And many transit agencies haven't been able to recover their ridership enough and their revenue enough to make up the difference. Those federal funds have actually subsidized the operations. And so now they're coming to a fiscal cliff. We also have had a collapse of the OEM industry here in the United States. I'm sure you've heard about it, but a year ago we had 5 bus manufacturers. Today we effectively only have 2 in the United States. And so that is a dramatic impact on transit agencies. And then, like I mentioned, the ridership levels have basically leveled off now, post-pandemic, at about 80% in most cities. Some are more, but on average, it's about 80%. So we have a 20% gap, and ridership patterns have changed with hybrid work schedules. So transit agencies are having to adjust to that as well. So how are we as an industry addressing those challenges that we're facing? Well, that's what we're going to find out today by talking to our 4 CEOs. We're going to ask them to tell you how are they addressing these challenges. Tiffany, tell us about some of the big challenges you're facing now.
So I think as an industry, identity is really an issue. Like, what is transit? Before COVID, we all kind of knew who was chasing the choice rider. There was a lot of talk about commuter transit. Everyone went to a certain place at a certain time. Peak hour service was always a big challenge, whether it was on the fixed route or on the paratransit service. And then COVID happened, and it really forced us to think outside of that. And you mentioned the fiscal cliff, but with us, we had made the brave decision to change our service model 3 months before COVID. And so we really had to lean into it. And so I think as much as there's challenges, I think one of the biggest challenges in transit is that it's easy to say we're doing things differently, but all we do is do the same thing and call it something else. And so really at our agency, we've leaned into what is the community now? We took our software, which is actually passed, and said, if I can schedule trips for people, why can't I schedule trips for things? And it ended up being a really great challenge for staff because it made you think, what can we do? And I think one of the best things that we've done, and even as a CEO, I went and spent like 2 months in my free time, which is very limited, learning how to schedule. And I can schedule an entire paratransit day. But that I needed to know, where is the naturally occurring slack? Where do we have the most elasticity to deploy new projects? And it was the idea of leaning into, we know where people are going, but why? What if we start asking why they're going? And so we followed that up with some routes that are now funded through the Areas of Persistent Poverty Grant. We were one of four in California awarded, where we're going to look at access to healthcare. It's been a big issue in most communities, and we're starting routes to take underserved communities to healthcare, but we're going to take it a step further and actually reach out to healthcare systems and try and figure out how do you get to the social worker so they can actually schedule a doctor's appointment on a day there's a route that serves that location. How do we change the conversation? And for me, I think that's where the challenge comes in, is pushing ourselves as agencies to realize we are not a transit agency. We are a mobility agency. We provide mobility. And I believe that's financial mobility, it's educational mobility, it's social mobility, and it's transportation. And we facilitate that because the number one challenge in these communities is access. And I think the hope I have is any of the challenges we're facing, we're chasing problem solutions that are bringing in that and really focusing a new look on what is transit in a community, because transit the way it was is not the way transit will be. And I think until agencies really take a hold of that, that's why we're not getting solutions that grab.
Kudos to a fellow past super user. All right, David, tell us about some challenges you're facing.
Well, I think you prefaced it really well in the introduction, Paul. You know, I think the challenges that we're all facing as an industry is, you know, what's the relevance of public transportation now? How do we get back to the utilization levels, the funding that we had pre-COVID, with the fiscal cliff, with challenges over having trained operators, mechanics, you know, the availability of workforce and all of those things? I'll just highlight one element. You know, for us as a contractor, the financial well-being of our clients, our PTAs, is absolutely fundamental, you know, to us. And so we are very aligned with our clients in order to address the challenges that they're facing head on, the challenges over future funding and the fiscal cliff. And I'll just focus on Boston for a moment. They're relatively early on during COVID, actually, you know, during 2020, the agency were very concerned about the future financing. This was before some of the stimulus funding had actually been made available, which has certainly helped, but they were already thinking about the longer term and operational funding. And so we worked very closely with MBTA to operate the network more efficiently, to reduce some costs, but also to change the service that was being offered to become more contemporary, to anticipate what we thought the future demand might be, which was around greater flexibility in travel options. You know, the commuter rail network there was designed and has operated for generations to bring lots of people into Boston in the morning and take them home in the evening. Well, that's not the way that people were traveling then. It's certainly not the way that they're traveling now. So we completely revamped the schedule. It made it more cost efficient to operate because costs are often driven by peak demand. So we flattened the peaks, but we spread the resources more evenly throughout the day. And our aspiration, which we've largely achieved, was to develop something that we call a clock face schedule, so that when you're traveling on the network, you don't need a schedule in your pocket. You don't need to look up online what time the train is going to be. You know that at 15 minutes past the hour or at 30 minutes past the hour, there will be a train on the hour, every hour throughout the day. So that's greater predictability for passengers and greater flexibility because we were able to offer a lot more frequent service. We've supplemented that with a range of other things that we've done around marketing, fares and fare product development, so offering very attractive weekend fares, for example, linking up with major events and introducing some digital tools to better understand the journeys that passengers are making, the potential journeys that people want to make, whatever mode they're making that journey on, and figuring out whether the service we're offering is really complementing those journey choices. And we've also digitized our onboard ticket sales as well, which was something we didn't have several years ago. You could only buy a ticket on board with cash. Now you can use your credit and debit card. So a whole range of things, and we've wrapped all of that in what we call a ridership and revenue recovery program, because the two things are not marching together hand in hand at the moment. We're seeing ridership coming back, and actually using that slightly tired metric of how does it compare to pre-COVID levels, you know, we've got 97% of pre-COVID ridership now on the commuter rail in Boston, which is leading the way in commuter rails in the United States, but revenue is still falling behind. And so now it's about understanding that relationship and doing what we can to address that challenge as well. But those are some of the things that we're working on right now.
Frank, how about you?
You know, probably the biggest challenge is just right now, the fiscal cliff to some degree. One of our biggest clients, obviously the Kansas, Missouri, they have a gap. And so the question becomes, do they want to close it or not close it? And so traditionally, and speak for Kansas City, we've got, like I said, we got this compact, got all these cool powers and tools, but historically, we really didn't use them like we probably should have, and we've been leaning towards really become that authority around the region. And so probably the biggest challenge that I've seen in my year and a half CEO is getting to understand you're not here to kick us around anymore, and we're going to basically demand where we go. We're going to look at how do we provide value by growing. I've said many times publicly that the KCATA is an economic development agency that happens to run transit. And so our message for the last 2 years has been workforce, growth, jobs, housing, all these things going to the state level, to the federal level. And we've seen that in returns and funding, because that's the things, to Tiffany's point, people care about these things because you're providing value to that. But the challenge is there's some people that want to keep us in that bus corner. And I'm like, we can't stay in that bus corner, because what we do is too important for the region. We got 7 counties. We've probably only been activated in 1. So there's 6 more counties that we can grow. We're working on a whole revenue strategy, a whole business development strategy to go tell that story to why you should invest in transit. People invest in what they value, but we got to tell a better story and back it up with the data to show why it matters. You know, there's people buying emotion, but they justify by fact. And so we're trying to marry a better way of approaching transit and what we do and how we do it. I was joking with Tiffany out before. I gave a speech 7 years ago that transit would be saved by non-transit people. It did not go over very well. But I don't come from transit, so I don't have those preconceived notions of what I can and can't do. So I've found this last year, I have fun irritating people, because we have to be different.
I can tell.
Oh, I lean into conflict. That's my superpower. But I'm an advocate for our industry, what we do. And if we can't love ourselves, who's going to love our industry, right? And we should let others define us. Everybody in this room knows everyone at the outside of industry thinks they're transit planners, right? They know how to, why doesn't this bus go left, go right, do it tomorrow. And we know why. There's rules, there's different things, but people like to tell us what to do. So from a challenge, I mean, ridership, we're up pre-pandemic. Operators we've hired. Our biggest thing is trying to redefine who we are within the region and make sure we're at the table when those decisions, the discussion are being had.
Thank you. It's great. How about you, Jameson?
Yeah, many of the same things that we've heard. But I think for us, our biggest challenge is our people. It's literally our people. We have wonderful people that work for the organization. We have wonderful people that we serve in the community. We have a very engaged community. But our community is different than it was a few years ago. You know, so in Oregon, there was a measure that decriminalized drugs to a certain extent. And I'm going to speak for TriMed as well, because they deal with the same things, but on a very big, higher level. You're able to do drugs. We have Eugene is the number one per capita community houselessness in the nation, Little Eugene. So we have houseless issues that we deal with. We have mental health challenges that we deal with on the street. We have a dilapidated police force. We have a reduced number of public defenders and prosecutors, and no jail. It's a very small jail. So there are unique challenges that our frontline folks face on the street. That, to me, is we'll always want more money, Paul, and we'll always want more vehicles. We'll always need inanimate objects. But the number one challenge, in my view, is the safety of the people that deliver the service each and every day.
It's a big, hot topic, no doubt about it. So now, for you all, I want to kind of pull the curtain back. We're going to shift and pivot, and I want to ask you a personal question. Tell us about what it's like being a CEO. I think not often does everybody get a chance to see, you know, what it's like. What time do you wake up? What do you do? I know an average day, there is no average day, but give us an approximation of that. David, we'll start with you.
Well, there is no average day. So a couple of things I'd say. I'm very operational. I'm a very operational CEO, so I'm close to our operations. I've been in operations most of my career, and so I wake up early. I do my best work early, actually, I think. Typically wake up at 5 a.m. I love working for an international company, but that does mean that time zones don't mean very much. So quite often there'll be very early meetings with Paris or late meetings with Australia, you know, sharing experiences. That's, you know, one of the facets of working for an international organization, but it's one of the ways that we share best practice, which is really important to us so that we can bring that to all of our clients. And then throughout the day, you know, I characterize it as, in fact, we were joking a little bit about this with Julie. you know, maybe you don't think this, but my perception is a lot of people, when they see a CEO job title, think you're all seeing and all knowing. Well, I can tell you, you're not. Absolutely not. You don't know the answers to everything. You depend on the people that work with you to bring their experience, their capabilities, their knowledge, to challenge you, to stretch you. You know, there's an old adage, surround yourselves with people who are brighter than you are. And I've certainly done that. And so throughout the day, I'll be dipping into various topics. Some of it will be quite technical around the operations. Some of it will be corporate governance stuff. You know, I've learned more about insurance, risk and claims than I ever thought I would, and probably more than I want to. But you, as a CEO, you have to touch on all of these things throughout the day. But just to pick up on something that Jameson said, one of the things that has really been driven home to me since I became a CEO is that the organization looks to you for guidance and moral leadership as well. And that's something that's really important. And I think as a CEO, you've always got to have at front of mind. You know, I'm a very strong believer in servant leadership, particularly over the last 5 years, I would say, in the US. People who work within your organizations look to the leadership of the organization to say, what's your commentary on social issues? You know, what's your view on the political climate right now? How are you going to help us overcome the challenges that we faced with COVID, with the post-COVID issues, with mental health issues? And so that's a big, big part of being a CEO. There's all the technical stuff and the operational stuff, but then there's that ethical and moral element to it too. And I think that's something that, you know, increasingly is important right now.
How about you, Frank? What's a day like for you?
Well, first of all, being a CEO is very lonely. And I don't say that in jest. I mean, because you make all the decisions, they fall back on you. I think we have talked about this in the past, Paul. I'm responsible for 650 people and their families with every decision I make every day, good or bad. And that's a weight that you take very seriously, because these people, they're going to work every day, they're planning for their futures, and they don't know what we know as CEOs, and nor do they need to know what we know. But when you look at all the information that you get, it's a lot. And so if you're doing it right, you take that seriously, to your point of the leadership piece. But every day is different. You know, it's a crisis at 8 o'clock. It's solved by 10 o'clock. Then there's another crisis at 11 o'clock. The biggest thing in my role, I am not an operational person. I just got a good line of BS. That's why I'm here. My job is to lead and make decisions. And I've got the operational people to go do that. My job is to go out there and go tell our story, go deal with what we call the political sticky stuff, all the things, you know, the trips and all these things, and really go say, I'm advocating for our organization a way to go tell that great story. But you get drug into things that, like, I've learned more about finance in the last 4 months I ever thought I'd know in my life, because you're trying to solve problems. Or is it operations, now we're about maintenance and all these things and jacks and lifts that I would normally not even care about, but I have to know about it because I've got to answer for it. I don't get to say I don't know. I don't get to say, well, it's not my fault. No, I'm the guy. And so you have to own that. And so it can be very heavy, but at the same time, you get to see the impact of the decision that you make on the good side. When you talk to people and get to know the folks that you're responsible for, it's crazy. I love it. I love being in charge. I love being able to say I have a hand in this thing. I love seeing people grow an organization that move on. I try to find people better than me, and I hope they leave for something better. If I've done that, I've done it right. Because then you elevate and people feel that space, you elevate, they feel that space, and you're a people developer as well. And then also people look to you, to your point, to the tone and the environment. And I will say, I don't know. Let me be very clear, I'll say, I don't know, let me find out. But what people do know about me at the ATA is I'll never lie to you. I'll defend this to the hilt in spite of whatever, and that I am there for the agency and all the people. So if you get the chance to become a CEO, I would say run to it. Because you'll learn a lot about yourself. You thought you knew stuff that you don't know, but I'm better now than I was 2 years ago. But no, it's crazy. There's always something going on, but I mean, it's just fun. I like solving problems, and I get to solve problems here.
Two things that I took out of that and that I want to share about CEOs, and then we'll ask you, Jameson, I'm going to follow that up with a question, which is, one is what you said. As a CEO, as the chief executive officer, the leader of any organization, you have the power of a spotlight. And you can spotlight issues, and your staff runs to them and works on them. But normally, it's one issue at a time. The problem is, at a CEO, you're faced with easily 100 decisions a day, I think, that you have to make. And you have to figure out where to put that spotlight, where the focus will be. The other thing I found was interesting as a CEO, and I want to ask you about this, Jameson, is that It seems like all the easy decisions have already been made by the time it gets to your desk. And the only ones that you have to make are the toughest ones and the ones without a template. You know, it's like a judgment call. That's why I wrote a chapter in my first book called, you know, Being a CEO is about your job, is your judgment. Do you agree?
Oh, I absolutely agree. That said, I'm having a blast.
There you go.
You know, and I have a great board that can help. I can bounce ideas off of. I've got a great team that I can bounce ideas off of. But at the end of the day, Frank's right. The decision happens here, and you have to live by that decision. Now, the great thing is that most decisions are reversible, right? You decide you're going to have an amputation. You better think real hard and make the right decision. It's not growing back. But most decisions, we'll go back, we'll assess, and we'll course correct. So it's an iterative process. But, you know, the buck does stop here, and you make the best decision that you can with the resources and information that you have.
Tiffany, what's your day like?
So I guess the best way to put it is I'm a firm believer that a CEO means before I ask anyone to do anything, I have to be willing to like work harder. So before I ask them to do overtime, so I wake up and I immediately, like, I get my cup of coffee and I check to see what it is. And I'm kind of somewhere probably between both of you where I'm not in the weeds each day, but I log in each morning and I look to see how many drivers called off. But just because I want to know when I walk in, what am I walking into and what can I start helping with direction and empowering my staff before I even step in? Because those calls and those messages don't wait for me to be in the building. Because a lot of times I'm not in the building. My job isn't to be at my desk all day just there waiting for a problem. And so a big part of that is opening that ability for people to tell me there's a problem. Because a lot of people don't want to tell the CEO it's a problem unless it's really bad. But I also think that as CEO, my job is to be chief cheerleader. And I say that in the best way because my job is to cheerlead for our agency outside. Who are we? And, you know, there's a lot of thoughts that, oh, you go to dinners. Okay. Inside, they are not all fun. They are work. And when you're there, you're on. And people think that, you know, you go and it's the second you get there, you start smiling. And the way when you go to bed, if you're not in your hotel room, you're working. But that's all for this idea of you have to be the greatest storyteller for your agency because that's how we drive ridership. That's how we drive revenue. But I also feel like we have to be the big cheerleader inside. You know, we had to make a big decision, and I made a very tough decision in 2021 that we didn't do remote work. I brought everyone back because it was creating this culture where people felt expendable, like who could stay home and who had to be on the front line. But with that came things like vaccine mandates. It's about creating the culture and the tone. We have a lot of fun at work. We work really hard. But I think it's creating that idea that I dress up on spirit days and I bring things to the potluck because the idea is you don't have to just be a fun agency or a hardworking agency or a analytical agency. You can be all of them, but it's our job to set that culture on when is it fun and when is it serious and what's important. But ultimately, the CEO is responsible for setting all of that. And that creates people wanting to come to work. The idea of being an employer of choice because people want to be where they want to be. Since COVID, that's the number one thing. If you're going to leave your house, you want what you do to matter. You want to feel valued and you want to enjoy it because you have options to not have to leave that at home. And so I think more than ever, the job of a CEO is creating a culture where people feel like what they're doing matters and that they're appreciated and that it matters they show up to work every day. And ultimately, that's my number one job.
All right, our lightning round question. We have one time for one question left. I'm going to ask each of you to try to keep it under a minute. We'll start with you, Frank. What's one of the best things happening at your agency right now?
The biggest thing is the TOD work. You saw some of it when you come to Kansas City. We've had over 70 different projects. It's going to be about $60 million to the organization. And we're starting to make a lot of traction with it, not just within Missouri, but in Kansas, but also nationally. So it's work I started 4 years ago. Now Michael Riley's taken what I've done next level, but it's really allowing us to reframe that what we are from a bus company to a transit authority.
That's great. Jameson?
We're going through a process right now. We're asking the communities, what do you need us to be for the next 50 years? We know what we were founded to do, but what do we need to morph into? And that conversation has been dynamic and engaging. We have elected officials weighing in. We have community college presidents weighing in. We have internal teams weighing in. We're doing a workshop next week on this topic with city planners and others. So it's really about what do we need to be and how do we connect the entire county, which means that we have to be superb at our base level of service, at our transit service. So right now, the entire organization is focused on a singular goal of recruitment and retention, making sure that we're recruiting bus operators. We're reimagining how we handle training without sacrificing training. We're reimagining how we sort, where we source our people. We're looking at second chance programs. We're looking at putting people to work who need a second chance. And we're looking at working with other organizations that focus in on indigenous veterans, making sure that we're really being inclusive in that approach. So that's been exciting to see the whole organization galvanize around that, including our board, who started the ad hoc committee on this one subject.
Tiffany?
So for us, it's really that work that we're doing related to food and healthcare. We don't do anything little. So we started 14 routes that are A and B pairs, so 28 routes going from no fixed route. But it's really interesting because it's got us seats at tables we didn't have. We're involved in the housing discussion. We're involved in the food access. We're involved in the healthcare discussion. And we actually spun off and created a second nonprofit that's building attainable housing for a third of the cost of what the public sector was doing. But the key was transportation. It's a little different take on TOD. The operating system is so important. We're bringing transportation as a key operating element on how they should look at developing that. And the goal is to create a model for how the region builds housing that has transit at the table, service provided day one. That's not only creating a future for our agency and others, but it's actually watching other existing entities come back to us and ask to how to incorporate that. And so it's exciting to see where we can blend meeting the region's goals into creating a sustainable future for ourselves by meeting demand that gets us out of the hunting piece and really gets us into the, let us show you what we can do, because transit can do so much that the community didn't realize until we're there. And I think it continues to be our job to tell the story of how, if you want to accomplish all these issues, access is the number one problem and you can't do it without transit. And my going piece is, look at your data sets, especially from things like paratransit. I always tell public works, if you're looking at where to put in improvements, where is the most valuable sidewalk infrastructure, where should you do crossings, get your data set. Because only paratransit knows exactly what time of day people are going, where they're going to their door. We're not assuming they're going there. We know door to door, time of day, frequency, age, all of it. We have more data than almost any other planning set, but nobody thinks to access it.
David, bring us home.
I've been sitting here with my brain a bit of a scramble because I thought we'd have more time. So trying to pick the one thing. So if I got to pick just one, I can talk about this because it's in the public domain now, it's in the media. We've just made an unsolicited proposal to MBTA, so back to Boston, I'm afraid, to introduce a brand new train onto the network for the first time in probably 50 years. And it'll be a modern battery electric multiple unit, which can run under the pantograph and run under battery power where there is no pantograph. It'll be truly transformational if this option is taken up by MBTA. I would be introducing that train into service in 2027 on selected parts of the network. So from a customer experience, it'll be like nothing MBTA riders have ever experienced. From a quality of service, journey time, reducing the carbon footprint of the operation, it really checks all of those boxes. And really, I wanted to mention that because this is a good example of where we've been able to bring our global experience in introducing these sorts of trains elsewhere in the world to MBTA, almost as a free consultancy. We've found the solution, we proposed it, we would project management, the procurement, the facilities, the introduction to service, and then, of course, continuing to operate. But it's a great example, I think, of as a global transportation contractor where we can bring added value to our clients. And in fact, I need to give a quick shout out to the ENO Center for Transportation because they've just done a study on contracting and they've just published that study, and it really emphasizes one of these features that a contractor can bring added value. So I'm really pleased, proud that we've made that proposal, and I'm very, very hopeful that it does get taken up by the T, and we're able to introduce that to the riding public.
Great. Thank you all. If you enjoyed today, how about giving a round of applause to our guests?
This is Tris Hussey, editor of the Transit Unplugged podcast. Thank you for listening to this special 300th episode of Transit Unplugged. Special thanks to all of you listeners who have made this possible. And of course, to our guests, Frank White III, Jamison Otten, David Scorey, and Tiffany Scott. Now, coming up next week on the show, we have Emily Yates, CIO for SEPTA, the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Authority. Paul and Emily are going to talk about how innovation works in public transit. Do you know transitunplugged.com is the place to catch up on old episodes of the show? Why don't you give it a look? There's some great episodes from the past 7 seasons that you might really enjoy. Transit Unplugged is brought to you by Modaxo. At Modaxo, we're passionate about moving the world's people. And at Transit Unplugged, we're passionate about telling those stories. So until next week, ride safe and ride happy.